meeting. And I'd like us to open this meeting by observing a moment of silence for prayer or meditation. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning to the Public Service Commission delegation. I'd like to greet the staff, all stakeholders and all guests. And please feel free, this is our meeting. You are all welcome. What brings us together this morning is a briefing from the Public Service Commission on the 2017 MTPPS. To us, the Public Service Commission is an important and valued partner, and the MTPPS says that unless decisive action taken to chart a new course, the country could remain caught in a cycle of weak growth, mounting government debt, shrinking budgets, and rising unemployment. Much depends on the policy choices made and the effectiveness of their implementation. If I may echo the minister, hard choices are required to return the public finances to a sustainable position. So the brief by Public Service Commission will assist the committee ensuring that there is robust engagement and assessment of the risks that can affect improvements in our public service. This will also assist honorable members in unpacking critical issues such as human resource planning and performance, issues of governance, and the attainment of performance targets. It is clear that Parliament will need to fully consider all possible policy options on how best to use the limited resources that we have, especially in ensuring that our public service performs at a high standard and is responsive to the needs of the people. Let me once more invite you to feel free. And I'm looking forward to constructive and robust engagement. Thank you very much. We will then move on to apologies.
Good morning, Chairperson, members and guests. We received apologies from the Shopee College with Sik. Manana is attending to a family matter and then
honorable members, we have these apologies. We accept the apologies. Accepted. Thank you very much. Let's move to item number 3, which is presentation by Public Service and Commission. Over to you. Who's the leader of the delegation? Okay. Over to you, Mrs. Mandy.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. It is always a pleasure to interact with the committee, and it is one piece of work in our mandate which we really enjoy, because we do it at the behest of the committee. This morning I would like to introduce to the committee our new DDG, Irene Matenga, who will be doing the presentation. She is new in her position, but she's not new at PSC. She has grown through the ranks of the Public Service Commission, and she went out and did a stint at the presidency, and she's back with us. So she will take us through the presentation. Just safe to say that the key thing really that we're going to be sharing with the committee and providing the committee as a tool for oversight is around the whole issue of planning. But also to say that we will not dwell a lot in the areas of risk because we had already presented it to this committee, and that we have provided just an appendix that drills down to various departments as just as a monitoring tool for the committee. So we won't present that one in detail. Without much further ado, I'd like DDG Irene Matenga to make the presentation. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Madam, and let's also welcome you and congratulate you for your new appointment, and we are looking forward to a very strong relationship, and we have all the benefits from Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, Commissioner, colleagues, good morning and thank you, Chair. I will be taking the committee through the presentation that we prepared as a result of the request by the committee to comment on the medium-term budget policy statement. On this slide that is projected, Chairperson, we're giving the outline of the presentation, basically being the introduction, and then we have also outlined the issues that were raised in the invite, which is basically strategies available to improve management practices. We'll touch on the governance issues, expenditure against budgets or versus performance. We'll look at opportunities for efficiency, effectiveness, and value for money, measures to ensure effective and efficient performance. We'll look at the proposed measure request, safe to say that we won't go into the details of that, and then we'll obviously conclude the presentation. Chairperson, we make use of various sources of data, and this includes annual reports for 14-15, 15-16, 16-17. We also made use of data coming from other institutions such as the DPME, the National Treasury, the DPSA, but also our own databases within the Public Service Commission. At the time of preparing this presentation, we did not have two annual reports, and those were of the Department of Defense and Environmental Affairs. In the case of cooperative governance, the annual report was available, however, we were informed that it was in the process of being amended. When we go to the introduction, Chairperson, we are saying that government spending plans remain focused on achieving the objectives of the MPSF, which is seen as a vehicle to drive the implementation of the National Development Plan goals. The priorities highlighted in the 2017 MPBPS remain education, with emphasis on higher education and the shortfalls thereof. Issues of health, issues of local government, social development, in terms of our sexual security assistance, and also economic development. However, this presentation will not comment on this prioritization. In terms of the strategies that are available to improve management practices in the public service, we start with planning, and we argue that detailed and integrated planning across all spheres of government is the foundation for ensuring effective and efficient performance. At the moment, there is clear planning framework. However, the emphasis should be on the collective responsibilities, and this requires better coordination, collaboration, integration amongst departments into practical approaches and strategies. Mr. Messon, you would be aware that if you look into some of the developmental states, they have really put planning as one of their priorities, and they've emphasized the need for central coordinated planning, and some of those would be your South Korea, your Malaysia, your China and Mauritius. So they have succeeded in building those capable and developmental states because planning has been one of the key activities that they put attention on. And we also say that we need adequate capacity to set proper targets of those plans which are aligned to the budget. And this will address the slow and ineffective implementation of programs as mentioned by the minister. So what we have at the moment in our country, as I said earlier on, is that we do have the planning framework at a much higher level. You have the National Development Plan, we have got sectoral plans, we have got plans for strategic plans and ATPs, and at a much lower level, you have the IDPs. However, what we don't have is the synergy, the integration, and the coordination of these plans, and that is very important. If we move to the next slide, Chairperson, departmental strategic and annual performance plans are not sufficient basis to make the real strategic trade-off in terms of the decisions that are contained in there. At the moment, it's really work as usual or business as usual. So departments do not present treasury with spending options from a cost-benefit point of view. And to present that to treasury, departments would require good planning and financial modeling capability. And unfortunately, we still lack this kind of capability within a government. And this kind of good planning and financial modeling that we're talking about should take into place the local context where we are delivering these services, and would require, for instance, scenario planning and also forecasting. Now, the key intervention to improve this would be that departments acquire this kind of capacity that we're talking about. However, in acquiring this capacity, it is important that these people, as they do their analytical work, they should be given the priority and in terms of making the hard choices as well as difficult compromises. However, they should be listened to. Because having this kind of capacity in place and providing recommendations in terms of how we are supposed to make improvements, but also not taking a cognizance of those recommendations, is not going to help us. As we move on, Chairperson, we talk about organizational performance management, which is important and that should be improved. And what we're saying here is that if the meaningfulness of performance information in annual reports are not drastically improved, then we won't have a meaningful conversation about performance. And this is as a result of constant changes in programs. We'll elaborate more on this point as we go further into this presentation. What we found in annual reports is that there's too much detail on activity level. Focus should be on service delivery objectives as well as outcomes. So there is a need for more than 1 year's data so that we are able to do trend analysis and able to measure whether there is performance in this. On human resources management, the PSC has observed challenges with compliance with legislative frameworks and prescripts governing public administration. So sound tools have been developed. They are in place to improve human resources. However, the use thereof is very poor. Just as an example, the recruitment and selection system that we have currently is really falling short of giving us the kind of capacity that we require. Secondly, the performance management and development system that is in place was actually meant to improve performance in the public service. However, it has been reduced to a reward system. And Chairperson, if you look at the PSC, one of the flagship projects that we did was a discussion document on the capable and developmental space in terms of the role of the public service and how it can be efficient and effective. And we elaborate more on these issues and what should be done in that area. And we feel that if we are to reward public servants, we need to reward those that are able to make contingent decisions and which are able to provide us the kind of interventions that are complicated and that were not anticipated by policy. In terms of financial management, we take cognizance of the efforts made by the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer in terms of transversal contracts, price referencing system, and strategic sourcing reforms. However, this must take effect so that we have the kind of savings that we anticipate, we cap corruption, and we can increase value for money. There is a need also to ensure that there is capacity building and professionalism in the supply chain management. However, this should be also accompanied by rigor, particularly in how we award contracts. Not only rigor, but accountability for those who make decisions in that area so that they can be held accountable. On professional ethics, one of the key products that we have produced as the Public Service Commission is the Code of Conduct, which is the foundation for ethical conduct, supported obviously by other tools that we'll also talk to as we go through the presentation. However, we still find that there is a lot of unethical conduct that persists. Therefore, an intervention is required to promote ethical conduct beyond the rules. This should be underpinned by a value-driven approach as set out in the Constitution. What we pick up in terms of professional ethics, Chairperson, is that officials tend to think that they limit the understanding of professional ethics just on perhaps financial misconduct as an example. So issues of a person coming to work, doing their work effectively and spending their time doing their work, that is part of professional ethics. So if people are not at their desk and doing their work, they are also robbing the state of the money that should be going to service delivery. Chairperson, we'll move on to issues of governance, and here we'll talk about the performance management, financial disclosures, financial misconduct, payment of invoices, precautionary suspensions, and the vacancy rate. The foundation of effective governance and accountability is performance agreements. Now, as you would know, DGs and SODs in the public service are required to enter into performance agreements by end of May and submit performance agreements signed by the executive authorities by the end of June. In terms of the trend analysis, we have found that there is a slight increase in the submission of performance agreements by DGs. In 2017-18, we're sitting at 74%. These are the performance agreements that were submitted on time as required. As we go to the next slide, as provided by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, as of August, the six departments that had not submitted the performance agreements of their HODs were Civilian Secretariat for Police, Correctional Services, Defense, the Secretary of Defense, Human Settlements, State Security Agency, and Public Enterprises. And I emphasize as at end of August 2017. It should be noted, Chairperson, that acting duties are not required to submit performance agreements. They submit performance agreements in their capacity in those positions that they have been employed for, not as acting directors general. Now, in 2016-17, there was an increase in the number of acting DGs, that is 17 against the 14 in 15-16 out of the 48 national departments. But what we picked up in 17-18 is that we had only 11 acting DGs out of the 47 national departments, and that translated into 23%. The departments that had acting DGs are the ones that are highlighted at the bottom of that slide. Now, on the turnover of the DGs in the public service, what we picked up from BPSA at end of September is that the average time spent by a DG in a post has improved over the past years from 2.7 to 3.0. That would include actually your national and provincial HODs. Now, at national level, the average is just above 3.5 years, whereas at the province is below 3 years. This figure, if you compare them with those that have been reported by the Institute of Race Relations, are a little bit higher. However, before I get there, if you look at the Institute of Race Relations report, it indicates that of the 38 key national departments, there were DGs that were on fixed-term contracts, and therefore the figures represent on average 22 months for a DG in a post before a change occurs. Chairperson, we need to interpret these two reports in a particular context in terms of the scope of these two reports. if you look at the Institute for Race Relations, it focuses only on national departments, but not all national departments. They focus on key departments only. And if you look at, obviously, the 3.08 of the DPSA, it represents the entire public service. But also the period of these two studies are not the same. The DPSA is focusing on the MTSS period, is 2014 to towards 2019, whereas the Institute of Race Relations study, their period of assessment was from May 2009 to March 2017. However, despite the differences, the statistics confirm the concerns alluded in the National Development Plan regarding instability at political administrative interface. So the PSC has taken this matter quite seriously. We have engaged with the Minister for Public Service and Administration and also the Minister in the Presidency to discuss issues pertaining to career incidents of DCs and SODs. In 2014, the PSC submitted a report to the Presidency after the precautionary suspensions of some of the DCs, requesting that the role of EAs in disciplining SODs be clarified. And the PSC is also mediating in some of the current disciplinary cases. The PSC has engaged with executive authorities after investigating grievances of HODs, and in some instances, those interventions have led to reinstatement of some of the HODs or deployment to other areas where their skills can be appropriately utilized. However, we need to also mention that in some instances, we are not able to intervene because the parties end up pursuing legal action. Chairperson, as we move to the financial disclosure framework, all SMS members are required to disclose their particulars of their registrable interests, such as companies, properties, to their respective authorities by not later than 30 April of each year. If you look at this slide, the compliance rate, for instance, for 16-17 in terms of submission of this financial disclosure form was 99%, with 47% of the departments having submitted 100% of the forms by their SMS members. Now, the total number of SMS members was 6,045, and the number of forms that were submitted manually, we indicate them. The number of forms that were submitted through the e-disclosure, and we're saying that only 66 financial disclosure forms were not submitted, and that's how we got to the 99% overall compliance with the submission. And then on these two following slides, the person, if you look at the extreme right of the table, the second last column, we indicate per department those that did not reach 100% submission rate and how many forms are still outstanding in those departments. For instance, you'll see correctional services, you'll see defense as one of those that have got high number. And as we go to the next slide as well, you will see departments such as rural development and land reform with 8 forms that are still outstanding, and police there, 5 forms that are still outstanding. Now, the most important thing here is that the submission of these financial disclosures is a compliance thing. We want 100%. We are not happy with departments submitting 99%. 100% should be achieved. And we also take cognizance of the fact that some people could be on leave due to sickness and so on. However, the introduction of the e-disclosure should make it easy for those who are able to disclose, because people do not necessarily have to be in the office. Also, those that are on precautionary suspension, there's nothing that excludes them from filing their financial disclosures. And we are raising a concern with EAs where these forms have not been submitted. However, the cost of financial disclosure is what we find as we scrutinize this form. So, Chairperson, if you look at this slide, we are looking at the departments that had a high potential conflict of interest in 15-16 disclosure forms, and where we found them to be above 50. The first one, for instance, the number of forms that we scrutinized from the subs was 862, and the forms that had potential conflict with 73. And below that, just as an example, we also indicated in terms of the level where we found that there was a potential conflict. So in the just as an example, the 18 national commissioners form, 7 DDGs, 7 chief directors, and 48 directors. I'm not going to go through all of them. I think the gist is provided there. And as we go to this slide, Chairperson, we also note that potential conflict of interest were identified for the following DGs, and we have outlined that. We become very much worried if the leadership of departments themselves, in the disclosure of their registrable interest, there are instances of potential conflict of interest. And we feel that this should be addressed as swiftly as possible. Now, the Public Service Commission, after conducting the scrutiny, we sent to the EAs of those respective departments and informed them of our findings of our scrutiny, and we request them to do further investigation. And where it is found that there is actual conflict of interest, we request that action be taken, disciplinary action be taken, and we also request that they should respond back to the TSC and tell us what action has been taken in each and every of those forms. So currently we have issued the letters to the departments to highlight the findings of the scrutiny of the forms, and we await feedback from departments. As we move on, Chairperson, we find that there is a significant increase in the finalization of financial misconduct. You can see that in 2016 we finalized 238 financial misconduct. In 2017 we finalized 758 financial misconduct. In relation to the cost of financial misconduct and the recovery, just an example, you can see that in 2016-17 we had 246 million amount that was involved in financial misconduct, and only 5.7 million was not recovered, which represented 2% of the money not recovered, which is an improvement if you look into the previous financial year. And then as we move with financial misconduct, we have highlighted departments where amounts not recovered were over 500,000, and we also give reasons on the side of this slide. And it's public works, it's the IT, then it's basic education. Chairperson, the issue of payment of invoices remains a very challenging one, and as we all know, cash flow is the lifeblood of small businesses. And this is not just about compliance with TSMA, this is about government efforts for inclusive economic growth, but also to ensure that there is we improve our employment base in the country. So failure to supply to pay suppliers timely is financial misconduct. We are aware that there's a special unit established at the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation that is working with other departments that is working on this matter to ensure that departments pay invoices on time. Also, including investigation of those cases, liaising with those departments, putting mechanism in place to assist departments where they are struggling with the payment of the invoices. Now, if you look at the statistics in this financial year from April up to September, on this slide, Chairperson, we highlight the invoices that were paid after 30 days. So these invoices were paid, but they were not paid on time. We take cognizance of the fact that at least the money is circulating in the economy, but it's important that these invoices are paid within 30 days as required by the Treasury regulations. Now, of concern is the invoices that are older than 30 days and not paid. Now, if you look at the two quarters again from April up to September, you will find that at end of September we had 8,925 invoices to the tune of 36 million if you round it up, that was not paid to service providers. Just on this one again, Chairperson, I need to say that if you do the thorough analysis of all the departments in this quarter or at least end of September. We had about 21 national departments that had paid all their invoices timelessly throughout the last quarter, which is July, August, September. So if we go to the next slide, you will see actually that 8,000 invoices that we're talking about, where are they, who has not paid these invoices, and what are the amounts related to that, which actually tells us that at national level, the problem of payment of invoices is really concentrated in few departments. Perhaps if one can use the language of AG, you have got departments that are doing very well, that have got a clean record of paying invoices over a period. Then we have got the second category of departments that would default here and there with two or three invoices. However, this slide begins to tell us where the problems are. For instance, Public Works perpetually is one of those departments that tend not to pay their invoices on time. And even on this slide, you can see that the majority of those invoices are actually in the Department of Public Works as well as PMC, which is their entity. We move over to precautionary suspension, which is a good indicator for the health of Human Resources Administration in departments. And we argue that if officials are placed on long periods on suspension, it means that departments are not dealing promptly with disciplinary processes. And if department is not dealing with discipline, the probability is high that HR processes are not also efficient. But what this means for us is that it compromises the very same capacity that we complain about in the public service. Because what it means is that people that are not at work, their work has to be done by other people as well. So if you look at the 16-17 statistics, for instance, we had about 844 officials that were suspended, and the number of those that were suspended that exceeded 30 days was 625. And if the next slide actually tells us where the challenge is in terms of the precautionary suspensions. And you would see SAPS seems to be the one leading throughout the period 2014-15 up to 16-17. At 16-17, they had 412 officials, and you could see that they were followed by correctional services and justice and constitutional development. Now, the zero there at defense in 16-17, as I said earlier on, was because we did not have their annual report to gather the information in that regard. Chairperson, we are worried about the increase in the cost of suspension, particularly under the very difficult financial constraint environment that we're in. In 16-17, the total cost for precautionary suspension was 98 million. In essence, this is the money that we've paid officials that have been on precautionary suspension. On vacancy rate, if you look at 2017, as at September, we had the total number of posts 328, the post that we filled was 310, which gave us a vacancy rate of 5.5%. And we also take cognizance, Chairperson, that in 2017, when we looked at our data source, which is Vulindlela, we did not have information relating to departments such as Defense, Home Affairs, National Treasury, Rural Development and Land Reform. So I think we need to interpret these statistics with that caution. So information relating to this department was not available on Vulindlela. However, the main concern here is those departments that had a vacancy rate, a high vacancy rate, which we are highlighting them. Again, Public Works come out as the first department with 53.4% vacancy rate. I need to indicate, Chairperson, that just as an example, again, Public Works is one of those departments that are contributing to the medium-term strategic framework in terms of supporting departments to provide accommodation that supports service delivery objectives. Now, in that area, when we investigated, we found that Public Works is not doing well in terms of assisting departments with accommodation for service delivery. One of the things that they complain about is because they don't have capacity, they've got a high vacancy rate and they don't have capacity. And in some instances, where they obtained service providers to assist them, they were not properly managing those professional teams. So this vacancy rate is very important, as it's not just about the number of people that are in the office, but the capacity of departments to deliver their service delivery objectives. And in this one, we are worried because many departments tend to complain about public works and the issue of accommodation with stifled service delivery. As we move on, Chairperson, we are highlighting here 10 departments that have not achieved, or with the lowest performing lowest performance in terms of achievement of their planned targets. And this is the information that Commissioner Zimande indicated earlier on, that the details thereof are in the annexes. But if you look here, you would find that actually the Department of Women achieved only 31.4% of their planned targets. I treat like that as the figures begin to grow. But all of these departments were the 10 lowest that achieved their planned targets. Again, on this slide, Chairperson, these are the departments that spent below the norm of 98%. The telecommunication and postal services had 73.4%, and so on and so on. So all of these departments, as I said, they spent below the norm. And we are worried about departments that seem in terms of the trend analysis, that performance is going down. However, what we are doing is that the name changes, the measures, discontinuation, introduction of new programs makes it difficult to establish the trend in the performance of national departments. And this is the point that I made earlier on. So we find that there is a lot of instability in terms of the structures of departments. You look into this annual report, the department has 3 programs. You look into the next annual report, a department has got 5 programs. And then there are also name changes in the program, which makes it a bit difficult in terms of assessing performance. Chairperson, we also include that, or we also indicate that of the 47 departments, there are 16 that have made those kind of changes that are related to. And you will see at the bottom of those slides that we indicate those departments. And then the table there just shows generally which departments' performance has gone down in 2016-17 as compared to 15-16 in relation to their plan targets. So you've got basic education, health, energy, human settlements, IT, Office of Chief Justice, Public Works, women. When we looked at the annual report, generally there seemed to be an improvement in terms of the use of consultants. But in this slide, we picked up specifically those departments with an increased number and cost in the use of consultants. And those are energy. You would see that in 15-16 they used 8 consultants, and in 16-17 they used 120 consultants. And we give those figures again, which shows clearly that there has been an increase as well as in the cost involved of those consultants. Opportunities for efficiency, effectiveness, and value for money. Of the 20 of these 27 departments, the following department it has the highest cost. So we have got the National Treasury. I'm not going to read all of that, but perhaps just as an example, we've got the National Treasury that reported the cost of 527 million, of which 10 million was spent on the infrastructure delivery program, delivery improvement program, 8.2 million on service provider to develop and deliver training programs to support infrastructure delivery management system, 5.2 million provision of technical assistance to the IDF, and 4.7 to support the Free State Provincial Treasury with implementation and management of their IDMS. So these are the departments and the kind of cost that in case that results were higher. I'm not going to go through each and every of them. And then we will move chapter 10 to slide 40, where we're talking about the measures to ensure effective and efficient performance within the public service in the medium term. The issue around duplication, fragmentation of functions between departments should be addressed. We are very much worried about this. And we're saying, especially in the light of the economic challenges, the focus should be on how departments can add value to a joint venture instead of working in isolation. And this could actually include secondment programs for underperforming departments where there are capacity constraints. The effective utilization of governance and coordination structures is very important to deal with complicated issues, and these structures should be empowered to take decisions beyond the rigid prescript of the policy. We do have the government cluster system that should be improved, and it should work very efficiently to deal with some of the challenges that departments encounter, and they should guide and provide those kind of answers that are required without leaving officials on their own struggling and not knowing how to go about and doing their work. At service delivery points, we also pick up chairperson that we need to empower officials at that level, particularly with financial and human resource delegation, so that they're able to take decisions and be able to deal very swiftly with obstacles that makes it difficult for them to render services. As we move on, chairperson, we say tough times require tough decisions. I think this is the message that has been clearly articulated. And we are also worried, whilst the Public Service Commission is responsible for the public service, which is the national and provincial departments, there are departments that are also responsible for the SOE. And in this area, we raise a number of concerns. We have realized that there have been SOEs that have got challenges that relating to their governance, and this has been going on for a while, and it needs to be attended as quickly as possible. Poor governance, corruption are threatening the economic viability of these enterprises and tarnishing the image of government. We have seen all of this really playing itself out in the media. There is also a need for departments to exercise their oversight function on the SOEs. There seems to be some level of independence on the SOEs that they do work without being monitored, or they persist to be doing work without being monitored and not being held accountable. And this can be achieved through, amongst others, revised legal frameworks to clarify the ownership relationship between the state and SOEs. There is a need to review the reporting arrangements of public entities to make them more accountable. Good enterprise require capable people, and therefore there's a need to appoint suitably qualified individuals on board based on merit. We need to introduce amendments or effect changes to the existing legislative framework in order to ensure that there is excessive, the excessive independence of SOE is kept, and that the developmental mandates of SOE becomes the dominant purpose for their activities and operations. This matter is clearly articulated in the MDP. And certainly we are aware that there is an IMC on the state-owned enterprises, and we are hoping that the IMC will also come up with better solutions to this area, and also in terms of implementing the Presidential Review Commission on SOE. The major risk areas, these were provided to the committee previously. I'm not going to go into the details of it, but what we are saying here is that the high turnover of departmental leadership is a very risk area, and it impacts very negatively on the continuity and stability of departments, and that should be attended to. We also are making a comment on the risk regarding the how departments prioritize. And here, Chairperson, we are arguing that low priority programs should grow with less than the inflation, and high priority programs with more inflation. What is also important here, I think we need to be very decisive about programs that are really not performing, or programs that are not yielding the kind of outcomes and impact that we are really anticipating. And with evidence and evaluations, we need to be able to take those decisions that say this program is not giving us what we anticipated. And what are the options? Should we close it down? Should we merge this program with another program? And so on. The issue on how staffing implications on the budget and the filling of posts as well. It's a challenge, the moratoriums on filling of posts. And what we also picked up, Chairperson, is the fact that in some instances, due to the financial constraints, departments tend not to fill the posts and make use of that funds or those funds for goods and services. This should be addressed very swiftly, because it also gives an impression that departments actually don't need those resources and then they suffer capacity constraints. We also make an argument about the use of ICT to achieve innovation and efficient savings. Chairperson, in conclusion, we're saying within the current economic climate, the challenge of closing the gap between what is required and what can be afforded is wanted by governments across the world. Therefore, decisive leadership and greater accountability is required to make the scarce resources, to manage rather the scarce resources of government. The underpinning factor for improved accountability is to ensure that the right things are being measured using the right information. Performance information should be reliable and useful. This will create a foundation for more effective and efficient performance and service delivery management, grounded, as I said earlier, on evidence-based decision making. It is also imperative that measures are put in place to ensure that strategic plans are translated into feasible implementation strategies and performance targets supported by effective financial management. There should be clear articulation of milestones for the achievement of the NDP, which should be translated into respective strategic plans. And it's also important that there is integrated planning to jointly achieve priority areas, targets that need to be achieved, and that is stressed in that regard. Chairperson, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Well, let me thank you for the presentation and ask Honourable Member to write on some interesting questions, but we can also discuss areas that need to be elaborated upon. Over to you, Member.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Look, good presentation. I don't see much direct correlation between this and the budget, of course, so I don't really have much questions in that regard to the concerning the budget here. But it would be interesting, considering that you have an overview of the public service, that what your thoughts are on the current headcount of the public service and its long-term ability to reduce it, because most economists believe that is one of the problems in our country and many other countries. The headcount is too high. Is that a feasible objective in line with all the unemployment in South Africa for us to reduce our headcount of the public service? Then, out of interest, would you consider municipal employees also to be part of the public service? I'm not actually sure. Are municipal employees part of the public service? And on another point, there is a bar on all state employees effectively for doing business with government. That's contained in two places, from what I understand. It's obviously the Public Finance Management Act as well as the Municipal Finance Management Act. But not directly, also in the regulation. I'm actually trying to find that basis regulation. You guys have to know which number it is, etc. If you don't know.
Thank you for your intervention. Any other intervention? Honorable Kobaza. Honorable Nkonyane.
Yeah, I do share the same sentiment with a lot of the talkers the document is not saying much with reference to the medium temperature qualification. However, one is not going to ask one or two. I noticed that you do make mention of to make reference to what the Auditor General remarked about with respect to officials that continue to do business with government well after the law that seeks to prevent that came into effect. And that would be in effect somewhere in May. And indeed, some of the officials not only continued with doing business, but also got new contracts well after the effective date of the implementation of the Act, which goes against the spirit of what you are saying in this document. If you could make a comment on that. The freeze on the freedom of cost in the public service as part of cost containment. There is an argument, though, which says that a counter argument, which says that, that freeze in the freedom of cost partly responds to to the rising wage bill. There's another view which says that the wage bill is not necessarily the issue. What matters is the employment of appropriately qualified persons, especially at the level of frontline service delivery. If we want to build a capable state in terms of the national development plan. One would like to hear from the CFC whether you have it and look at that and weigh this issue of the wage bill, which is seen as a problem, against what others say, that may not necessarily be a problem. issue of the wage bill, but more the manner in which we employ and the level at which we employ, that should drive the pursuit of the National Development Goal. Let me stop at that. Perhaps I will come back and ask another question.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the presentation. I think I would like to also align myself with my colleagues. The first thing that I just want to comment on is the fact that most of the things that are really raised have been ongoing for all the years, and one asks oneself, are these departments in this area? And also, I would like to be in your shoes when you keep raising things every time and there's so little or no progress at all. The first thing I would like to just mention is the issue of this target setting and the lack of capacity. I honestly think this has become a song for all of us. Maybe my question would be, what really do you think, or I know you've read somewhere that you know this change in leadership and all that, it's one of the things. What do you think we should do, because we talk about this year in and year out, that there is lack of capacity, because then if that is the first thing, that we lack capacity in the department, obviously we aren't going to get any results. The other thing is the issue of performance agreements. I mean, all senior managers, for as long as I can remember, are required to submit performance agreements, to sign rather a performance agreement. But according to the report, we may say we are happy that there is improvement. But if by now we are only 74%, it's still a joke. Because it's been going on for years and years and years. And that is my take, that we are just going on and on, and these people that are supposed to really respond. Because in my thinking, when you produce this good report, which we always read and think that they mean something to everyone, people don't seem to really take them seriously. Because if they were taking them seriously, really would see some form of improvement. Code of conduct, how long have we had it? We've had it forever. But people are just not doing what they're... You know, this issue of ethical conduct, we preach it, we know it's a requirement, and any senior manager knows that they are, how they are supposed to conduct themselves, but they continue. But the one thing that I just want to ask you to explain the issue of saying the strategic plans and entities are not a sufficient basis to make a real strategic trade-off. There's a strategic trade-off decision. That's what I didn't quite understand what it means. And then the PMPS, you also said it has been reduced to a reward system. I know that when people I'm trying to guess, but just if you just explain it to me what it means, it's a reward system. I know people get rewards, but I also agree that people just get rewards and bonuses when they don't really deserve, as far as I'm concerned. And the issue of DGs that I change all the time, of course, will never make things any better. And the issue of the conflict of interest, really, for how long are we going to be dealing with this thing of conflict of interest? Because people know, but people simply are not prepared to comply.
So for me, it becomes a problem of, are we fighting a losing battle? What more can we do to make sure that people do something about this? Because when I look at the numbers, especially of directors that they have that potential risk of conflict of interest, yeah, it really worries one as to what actually we are going to do. Yeah, and then I'd like to just say something about the working to raise. The issue of, I think my colleague here has also spoken to the issue of working to raise. And this is one very tricky area, because we know that there is a moratorium by government as part of the cost savings measures. But it is so important that in doing this, we also guard against not feeling critical force. And if we don't feel critical force, then it also is quite counterproductive. But how do you find this area of work? Because they are supposed to definitely not feel some of the force. But according to the guidelines that have been given, because sometimes it does happen that when the person on a post, a very important post, and then if it's not fit, then we are again not helping ourselves in the name of saving, but we cannot do that because then work has got to be done. And then the other thing is just by way of commenting, really this thing of performance versus expenditure is just by way of commenting that it's just one of the things that I just was mentioning, that we are really not moving at all. Okay, on the issue of measures to ensure effective and efficient performance within the sub service. Where you say you need to introduce amendments or effect changes to existing legislative frameworks in order to ensure that the effective independence of SOE is kept. And that I understand that part of the excessive independence, and that the development mandate of SOE becomes the dominant purpose for their activities and operations. What actually is the mandate currently of these SOEs? I've been thinking that this is actually their mandate. So, but this is just for my own information, so that I can understand whether or not they are doing what they're supposed to do. Because that's another area where I think I will end there.
Thank you for the question. Before I hand over to Public Service Commission, I know there were remarks about the linkage of this presentation to the MTBTS budget, the 2010 budget process. I just want to remind members that the mandate of the, we ourselves have identified TSC as a strategic partner, particularly because their mandate entails the evaluation of achievements of government progress, and also the Commission promotes measures that will ensure effective and efficient performance within the public service. And I would also want to link that to the MCT. We need a capable and a developmental state that should be able to intervene to correct our historical inequities and strong leadership throughout society working to solve our problems. So in terms of this presentation, there is relevance. Because, for instance, they were able to
talk to us about the HR, because you must remember, without the personnel, even if government can have plans with the budget, but without capable personnel, those budgets will not make an impact in the national. So they have then been able to then identify the gap, and then so that we can, in our intervention, know how to, you know, zoom into those gaps or plug into those gaps when we interact with the department. So I think there is a relevance of the Public Service Commission coming here to give us about those inefficiencies that they have identified, and also, yes, I think they have made also some recommendations on what needs to be done. Now, I would also like to ask a question. It's about the irregular expenditure and targets that are in here. That also came out from this. And whenever we interact with the department, we also look at the rules, find that the irregular, and then also how that impacts on the spending. Uneconomic use of the limited resources, the future expenditure, and how it impacts on the spending, that is, on service delivery. So I still want to say there is relevance. So, but then to Public Service Commission, in your assessment, are there cases of actual application of consequence management? For instance, are there DDGs who have been demoted from your assessment? And what practical steps can we take, and what can we demand from executives as visible and tangible consequence management to build the confidence of the citizens? Okay. The other question is, what can be done with even Audit General of South Africa is being taken to court? Is there, because indeed that's an independent body, and that has always assisted us with their audit opinion, analysis of the expenditure report, financial statements, and has given us an audit opinion, and also they have been able to identify the gaps that have an impact on the expenditure on the actual service delivery. How can we bring back ethics into our public service? I think the other relevant issue that came from the presentation, you have precautionary suspension. There's a lot of leakage of wastage coming from those people having been on suspension for years and on the pension of salary. So that information also to us also indicates that where I think people want to talk about fruitless expenditure. That is fruitless expenditure. So I think that information also is about what can be done to correct. And also on the recruitment. The law says it is the recruitment turnaround is 180 days. But what we see here, the recruitment takes far more than 180 days. This is a question of non-compliance. So it's a non-compliance because the law does describe a turnaround in the recruitment process. Just like in your disciplinary cases, the law says it must not take more than 80 days. Now, if it takes more than 80 days, it's a violation of our own law. So what can we do then to try and turn that situation around? because this, the fact that it takes more than 80 days ends up with your precautionary suspension taking far more than, you know, it is expected. And to meet wastage. And we always say as the committee, follow the money and want to see value for money. And precautionary suspension and retention of salary, obviously there is no value for money. So what can we do? And it is true that we have serious budgetary constraints. And what we ask the government is to use all the available resources to create a better life for all, but not to let it leak, the resources leak, and we end up not being able to discharge some of our responsibilities because there is no money. I will then hand over to you to respond.
Thank you so much, Chairperson and honourable members, and thank you, Chairperson, particularly for explaining the link between our our area of mandate and our contribution to assisting this committee with their oversight and the actual budget statement. That our role really is to give the committee a window of saying, the budget aside, but what's happening in that space where Parliament is expecting that these resources are managed well. Just, I will address some of the issues raised, and I will also ask the DDG to fill in. Perhaps if I were to start with that area of the issue has been raised around SOE. I think this is really a challenge which as a country we really need to revisit, because I think we missed an opportunity at the beginning of our democracy when we were corporatizing these entities and did not put in mechanisms to say we are corporatizing them and giving them boards in order for them not to be settled with the day-to-day administrative red tape of government, in order for them to be free to get on with their mandate. But in that corporatization process, we did not make sure that we put a framework which government will be able to oversee them, that in that space that they are supposed to enjoy, they are continually delivering for the intended development objective. The DDG mentioned earlier that we've done some work in terms of looking at what is the role of the public service to contribute for a successful developmental state. In that work, we went around and did some research in countries who have similar socioeconomic conditions like us. For example, Mauritius, they've gone so far as to make sure that in the boards of state entities for each sector, their legislation says there must be a senior government official that serves on that board, who will be able continually to guide and contribute to making sure that what happens in that space is indeed in line with the contribution of that sector into the development objective of the country. I'm just making an example. We do not have such a framework, for example. In addition to that, is that some of the SOEs are overseen by the Department of Public Enterprises and others are not. They are overseen directly by the policy department. In there, there is a bit of a conjuncture in that, obviously, the framework for oversight is not the same. There was an attempt to make shareholder compact so as to be an agreement between the shareholder representative and the board as to what needs to be delivered. But some government departments have shareholder management units, others don't. So all we are raising is that in that space, I think we need to just revisit a little bit based on our experience now, 23 years down the line, what assumptions did we make about what the state-owned entities would deliver for the country, what has worked, what hasn't worked, and how do we move going forward. At the moment, we are doing it SOE by SOE, depending on the crisis that has happened in that SOE. I think we need to just step back and revisit. Perhaps where Parliament can contribute is to really just have a serious conversation with the Department of Public Services and Enterprises to say, what is your role in this space? What have you learned? What needs to be done? But at the moment, it really is a bit haphazard. The second issue I'd like to address is the one of headcount. Is there a magic formula that exists as to how many people we need in the public service to service 55 million people? The answer is no, we don't have. If we claim that a percentage of 40% or whatever that's not the case. The fact of the matter, we have 1.2 million public servants at the level of national and provincial sphere, excluding local government. Are there enough people to service 55 million people? I would say perhaps that's not the question to ask. The question to ask is for each sector, because if you come with a magic wand, there are some sectors like education, like health, where you really need a warm body on the ground to be able to take care of people, a warm body in a classroom to teach children. So you can't wake up in the morning and say you need maybe 40% or whatever. Perhaps the crux of the matter is in which areas do you have people? Because if you have most people in the administrative area rather than those that are at the coal face, the doctors, the nurses, the radiographers in the case of health. So you find that you have more administrative staff rather than the professionals on the ground, then maybe that is a problem. That's one. Two, if you find that you have the people but they are not properly qualified to deliver, maybe that's another. So I would go so far as to say I think in that area, we need to really ask the correct questions rather than just the number. Because I often worry about how we are very quick to make a soundbite like there's a bloated public service without actually drilling down and saying, when we say that, where are these people? In which sector are these people? And are they properly qualified? So perhaps Honorable Dwabaza has asked, has pointed to the real question that perhaps it's not so much the rising wage bill that is an issue, much as we have to be mindful of that, but it's a question of, do we have properly qualified people in the right sectors and in the right place, and it has to be drilled at a sectorial level. For example, with that, some of the stakeholders within the police service have said, perhaps we don't need so many people at a national office level. We need those people. people at a police station, at a police station level. So that's why I'm saying the question has got to be asked much, much more nuanced than a generic thing that says we have a bloated public service. The next one that I would like to just address is the issue of conflict of interest and barring public servants from doing work with government. Just to say to the committee, it is us as the Public Service Commission that actually made that recommendation for that it be in law. But what we are doing is having that law in place. What exactly is still happening in that space? So the information we have given is to say we having the legal framework in place seems not to reflect what is happening in reality. And we are also sharing with the committee to say in our oversight of what is happening in the reality, this is what we are doing. We are analyzing those, we are writing letters to the executive authority members in each department to say, this is what you have found. And we send them the senior officials, not just by rank, but by name. Tell us what you are doing to bring this official to book, and they're supposed to report back to us. Perhaps we can, if the committee wants for future, give them just a window and a breakdown of our report in that regard. But yes, the law is in place, but there are still some things that are untoward things that are happening in that area. Are there real examples of consequence management? Honorable Chair, I would not go so far as to say we've seen anybody demoted or in so far as that, but we have real examples of where action has not been taken, has been taken. Is there enough action? Our worry is that sometimes it takes a little bit longer, but it action does get taken as a result of our report, when we bring that to the attention of the executive authority. The issue of precautionary suspension and is really a major one. Perhaps what Parliament can do, and all committees of Parliament, is whenever a government department appears before any committee, no matter what the reason is, they are forced to have a slide of saying what is the extent of suspension in your department and why, and to what extent per category of a suspension have you followed the law. Because in terms of the rules and the law, you do not suspend anybody who's not likely to impact negatively on the investigation. For example, you do not suspend somebody because they have not performed a task. That's the bottom line. It's there. It's in black and white. But people just wake up in the morning, they look at people in their faces, and they suspend them because they don't like them or something. And then only then they start looking for the reason why they should get rid of them. It should not be happening, and I think that Parliament can do well here to make sure that each and every department that appears before Parliament, they declare that information. Who in your department have you suspended? Why? For those who are suspended, how long have they been out there? Where are you supposed to have suspended them in the first instance? I think the case of the DG of Home Affairs is a case in point, which he has now since been brought back. Those kinds of things ought not be happening in the public service. Bringing back ethics in the public service, I think what we have begun to do now as a public service commission is just to say, look, let's go back to basics. Let's try and promote these values that are in section 195 of the Constitution as well as chapter 1 of the Constitution. We have a whole drive now to promote these values within the public service, because many of the things that are happening in that space are a result of a public service that's not living the values that are there in the Constitution. But I think that it is really the responsibility of everyone to make sure that this happens. Let me allow the TDC now to fill in the gaps where I have not managed to touch base.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Commissioner. I think most of the questions have been responded to. Just to add on the issue of the officials that are doing business with the state, when we do this scrutiny, one of our sources of data over and above the CITC, the ENACIS, and the others is the Central Supplier Database of the National Treasury, where we are able to pick up through the person and the ID of a supplier that would have done business with the state. So in those findings of the scrutiny, we are already saying that this is a potential or actual conflict of interest that we have picked up regarding a particular individual in a department that would have done business with the state. And we also make use of VAT, which is the payment system. And then to move on to the issue of capacity, as a person, I need to mention that if you look at some of the developmental states and how they have managed to build a capable state, it's because they have really invested in the capacity of their institutions. They have made concerted efforts in ensuring that people are trained, people know what they're supposed to do and how they go about doing that. In the presentation, we also made an example of the kind of professionals that we require, and we made that example to say that those kind of professions are not available. But also, this is when you begin to take serious the issue of performance, because then you would have trained the people know what they expected of them, and you manage poor performance. Because we would have built capacity. On the issue of strat plans and APPs that are not giving us state of, if we look at these strat plans, which are 5-year period, APP is a 1-year period, what we found basically is just like a repetition of what we would have received the previous year. There is no major shift that says under the circumstances we are facing very serious economic challenges, and therefore we are our strategies are beginning to change to address and to adapt to the context that we have. So those strategic plans and APP, as we said, they are more at activity level rather than outcomes and service delivery level. They are still weak, and that is the point that we are emphasizing. On the PMDS, we're saying that it's a reward system. What we find is that officials are very quick, particularly at the level of the assessment, to award themselves a score of 4. If a score of 3 is effective performance, a score of 4 is above performance, a score of 5 is when somebody has done exceedingly well. So I think there is a problem there in terms of officials having gained the system. So at the time of performance assessment, officials give themselves a score of 4 with the hope that it will be brought down to 3. They give them a score of 5 with the hope that it will be brought down to 4. Even those that are really not performing, that should be giving themselves a score of 2, because in terms of the real output on the ground, you find that those have not been achieved. So we have a process at the moment. We have raised the issue with the DPSA. There is a review of the system to tighten those areas so that a performance management system can also be linked to a unit performance and organizational performance. It doesn't make sense to us that officials in a department or in a unit, they receive performance bonuses, but when you look at the plan target,
they have not been achieved, yet individuals are getting performance bonuses. Perhaps the other issue here on the PMDS per person as it relates to the issue of the DGs is that the function of evaluating HODs where they would be actually be held accountable for their performance used to be with the TSC. Around 2013, the system was taken to BPME, but there hasn't been a policy framework to guide the evaluation system of HODs. We have raised the issue with the MPSA to say that they need to fast track that system so that it's put back in place and HODs are able to evaluate properly, to be evaluated properly in terms of their performance. Obviously, that will cascade down to other officials. On the issue of, I think Commissioner has touched on the issue of the SOEs. The consequence management, we have touched on that. I think Chairperson, that was it.
Okay, thank you for your responses. Honourable members, do you have follow-up questions?
Sorry, Chair. I think this matter that emerging of the AG and entities and departments taking the AG to court, I honestly believe Parliament must put their foot down here. I think Parliament can just say, nobody takes AG to court until we hear what this story is about. I don't know which committee of Parliament would be able to do that, but it is actually quite bizarre. It really is bizarre. And sometimes, as a country, we do tend to allow, when we see a train coming and we say, oh, all it's all coming, and then we only start, you know, raising alarm when it crashes. Now, the train is on the wrong rail right now, and only Parliament can say, let it stop dead there, no further. I really don't know. I've never heard of it, but as it begins, I think Parliament needs to nip it in the bud. Before any department or entity takes AG to Parliament to court, let's hear what the issue is. And it will stop right there.
Follow-up question? I think it's one issue that we also as a committee have raised and we have discussed it. We have raised it. I think also we had a joint committee we raised it. And I think other committees have raised it. I can't say that it's what a solution, but we have noted it because it's becoming a new trend that we also we do not know where it comes from. It never has been. It's difficult for one department.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for the briefing and the observations about the process, the engagement between ourselves. And rest assured that this information will be of good use in our interaction with the department. Also in the actual implementation of those clusters and the point. Because the issue at hand now also to avoid in the LGBTS lack of confidence in the policy and their implementation. So policy implementation is about your HR, and then people who are skilled, and then people who know how to plan and implement the plan to the data, and also account for their work. And where there's integration, then I think that's where we have to want the consistent management, so that there can be an acceleration in the service provision to the people on the ground, but also acceleration in the economic transformation. Right now, we're closing for having the team.
I'm sorry. I got off at the ask if the PSD is it within your could it be within your mandate to have a look at the office of the chief private
Yes, we've taken note, we will look into it, chapter 3.
Okay. All of them, I don't need announcements, I don't, unless you can have announcements. And then there's no correspondence as well. Okay. Let me thank you for coming to make this meeting a success. And let me thank you for your